Good morning, this is Samuel Bonder, and welcome to the sacred tremor that sets our hearts free to love. A year-long or so series of recitations and commentaries on Yoga Spandakarika, the sacred texts at the origins of Tantra, by the French Tantric adept, contemporary adept named Daniel Audier, translated from the French by Claire Frock. I'm very pleased to present this recitation of the whole book, Yoga Spandakarika, and to make these commentaries on it to you. And I want to especially thank the folks at Inner Traditions Publishing Company, who have given me permission and a license to, in effect, perform the text as a recitation. Daniel Audier also offered special thanks to Anne Blum for her work in transcribing the oral commentaries in the book. I'd like to thank you, my listener, for being part of this journey with me. And you may be listening just to this first session to see if you want to go forward, to see if this is appealing to you. And if so, thank you for joining me. And I hope, even if you don't go forward beyond this first one, that you get a lot out of it. I'm doing this in my home. The home I share with Linda Groves Bonder, my beloved wife, who many of us call Linda Ma because she's got increasingly emergent qualities of divine mother to her. And I'm doing this mostly. I'll be here in our spare bedroom, our guest room, where many of our guests stay who come on residential retreat with us. The room, we've noticed, has a nice sound quality to it, kind of a baffling, muting tone in the audio environment of the room. I may be doing some of these sessions, recording them on the road, and I'm doing this, as you probably surmise, on a small but very good recorder. So this is not done in a studio, but it is done in what many people experience, and we certainly do, as a sacred environment. Our home is full of our transmission of the heart, of the mystery of being, of reality. And as you probably know, if you're listening to this, I'm a teacher and transmitter of that same mystery, as is Linda Ma. So this is being performed in our home temple for the most part. So there are some of the sessions I may be on the road when I make them. But it's certainly my pleasure while here to perform them in this environment. And hopefully you'll get the resonance, the tremoring, as Daniel puts it. I'm going to call him by his first name, Daniel. Hopefully you'll, the tone and timbre of my voice will that much more fully express and convey the sacred tremoring. And that's part of the reason I'm doing this, along with just the fact that it's my pleasure. So I'm going to go ahead and begin this first session. We'll start with Daniel's preface. To my first meetings with the great Chinese, Tibetan, and Kashmiri masters, I owe the idea of the profound similarity between Chan, and he notes that Chan is Chinese Zen. Profound similarity between Chan, Tantrism, Dzogchen, the Tibetan Mahamudra, and the original Mahamudra, that of Kashmiri Shaivism, a mystical movement linked to the teachings of the Mahasiddhas and to the Shaivism, or Shiva worship, of the Indus Valley from 6,000 years ago. Shiva is considered to be the creator of dance and yoga. His abode is Mount Kailash, and he holds a trident, which symbolizes humankind as the divinity, the temple, and the worshiper, all united in the main branch of the trident. In 1967, at the age of 22, I arrived fresh from my readings in a shocking and marvelous India that would destroy, one by one, the ideas that I had established for myself regarding spirituality. Armed with a letter of recommendation that Arnaud de Jardin, the French reporter and spiritual teacher, had quite willingly written for me, following my enthusiasm for his film series, Les Mystères des Tibétains, I set out for Delhi. There I met the director of the Tibetan Museum, who in turn sent me to Kalimpong to meet the most prominent leader of the Nyingmapas, Tudjom Rinpoche. So, a couple little comments here. Hope my French is passable, because I don't know how to pronounce French. And I want to acknowledge that the Nyingmapas are one of the several lineages of Tibetan Buddhism. As chance, a word cursed by spiritualists would have it, I stopped in front of a little house in which there lived a scholarly Chinese man by the name of Chen Ming Chen, author of some 100 works unpublished in the West. This little bearded man, dressed in a worn, stain-spattered robe, radiated dazzling energy and overflowing joy. He served me tea before a yogini whose legs were spread open upon the space that he spent his days and his early mornings contemplating in unending ecstasy. He gave me as gifts more than 20 of his works, all of which I still have. Among these was a commentary on the Vijnanabhairava Tantra, which it seems existed in Chinese, although it belonged originally to the Mahamudra of the Siddhas in the Kashmiri Shaivism tradition. This first meeting carried in seed form all of the future developments of my approach. Of all the works he gave me, which I carried about with me like a Himalayan mule, the Vijnanabhairava Tantra immediately and absolutely fascinated me. Chen Ming Chen was a follower of Chan, but also of Dzogchen and Mahamudra. He had lived in his hermitage since 1947 without ever having gone outside of it. And this again was 1967, so for 20 years. Curious souls, who were now locally financing his printed publications, had nevertheless found him. He fascinated both the masters of Hinayana Buddhism, as well as those of the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, along with a few scientists and academics. I spent only a few hours in his company, but they were a determining factor in my opening to these various streams. I spent only a few hours in his company, but they were a determining factor in my opening to these various streams. After having explained to me the ideal conditions for establishing a hermitage, conditions that I still remember and that governed my choice of place for my retreat in Tuscany, Chen Ming Chen, very modest man that he was, told me that he could not guide me on the path because his vow as a hermit constrained him to practicing only, and that he himself had not yet realized the ultimate fruit. He sent me to the great master and supreme leader of the Nyingmapa, Tudjom Rinpoche, the same man for whom the director of the Tibetan Museum of Delhi had written me a letter of recommendation. With regret, I left this remarkable man and arrived that same day at a lovely Indian-style dwelling, a bungalow perched on a hill, where I was warmly welcomed by Tudjom Rinpoche's wife. During those golden days, the greatest masters were accessible with surprising ease. Few Westerners were seeking the Dharma. Dudjom Rinpoche received me. He was a man who had an open gaze on the infinite, a perpetual smile on his face, great kindness, and an almost feminine gentleness allied with a gripping powerfulness. He had long hair and wore a Western shirt under his blue Tibetan robe. He granted all my requests. I had naively gotten it into my head to write a book on Tibetan painting with the support of the great art publisher Albert Skura, who had had me take a few courses on the photography of paintings and had then armed me with the appropriate materials. Dudjom Rinpoche had the tankas, painted rolls, brought out from the temple and watched me photograph them, then informed me with humor that in order to penetrate their secrets, I would have to practice the path. Troubles at the nearby Sino-Indian border, Chinese-Indian border, were such that foreigners were not allowed to stay in Kalimpong for more than 3 days. The Indian authorities were being driven by an acute sense of spy mania, and for them, any foreigner was a potential informer of the Chinese. In the face of my enthusiasm, Dudjom Rinpoche gave me, over the course of each of my 3 days, the essence of the Dzogchen teachings. It would be 30 years before I understood how simple, vast, and direct his instruction had been. Subsequently, I had the opportunity to meet with Kala Rinpoche and to express my gratitude to him. When I was leaving him, Dudjom Rinpoche gave me a letter of recommendation for one of his disciples who lived near Darjeeling, Shatral Rinpoche, also a great master of Dzogchen. This meeting would turn out to be rough and upsetting. Having arrived at his place, I pushed open the door to a kind of hovel, and I found Shatral Rinpoche in contemplation, his gaze absolutely still and open straight in front of him. Picture that. I pushed open the door to a kind of hovel, and I found Shatral Rinpoche in contemplation, his gaze absolutely still and open straight in front of him. I remember a brazier, a thermos bottle on the table, and a calendar bearing the effigy of Gandhi. Standing before the master's silence, I took out the letter, which he did not read. Abruptly and bluntly, he asked me what I wanted. I made my request, trembling. So irrepressible and marvelous was the energy he emitted. He leaped up, caught me by the collar, and took me to a spot behind his lair, where there were 6 little retreat cells, loose boards, and canvas roof. He opened the door and pushed me into one of these cubby holes, which seemed more like a latrine than a place for contemplation, and said, "Are you ready to be in this cell for 6 years?" I came right back out, frightened by the cold, the rain, the fog, and the smallness of the place. He laughed and told me, "In that case, I can do nothing for you. Start by learning Tibetan." I was quite happy at the idea of escaping from him. Just as I was leaving, he called out in a more friendly tone, "It's too bad. I only take 6 disciples at a time. There was an open space. You would have had the chance to attain awakening. But go down to Sanada. It's a few kilometers away. There you'll find your master." I walked in the driving rain, thanking the gods for my having escaped this big-nosed typhoon. I imagined that the master awaiting me was going to be even more insane. I had the surprise of my life when I came into the room where a magnificent old man with eyes full of love was playing with a cat, balancing cans on its head, the cat looking at him as if hypnotized. After a brief conversation, Kalu Rinpoche told me right then and there that I could think of him as my master or as my mother. I chose the second option and relaxed completely in his presence, which emitted love like a soothing and nourishing elixir. It was at Sanada that I undertook my long search, which would culminate much later with the transmission of the Mahamudra. I would discover over the course of the weeks that followed that Shatral and Kalu Rinpoche were very close. Shatral, at the wheel of his jeep, which he drove like a frenzied madman, visited Kalu quite frequently. He never missed the opportunity while I was there to make fun of this young, pretentious Westerner whose nose he had been so nice as to wipe. In the years during which I followed the teachings of Kali Rinpoche, I learned that he had realized the teachings of both the Dzogchen and the Mahamudra, the direct way, which many lives are not enough to teach. Kali Rinpoche said, "Mahamudra, the great symbol, or Dzogchen, the great perfection, are truly beyond the distinction between meditation and non-meditation. Thus, it is not really right to name them in one way or another. Because they are the outcome of all the practices, one can conventionally say that they are the highest form of meditation. Some people make a distinction between Dzogchen and Mahamudra, but that distinction is pointless because fundamentally, these are two names for the same experience." I think that's a beautiful statement, and this is a good place to offer a brief comment. I am, of course, offering you this recitation and commentary as the originator of the way that I continue to teach. His overall name for me is the White Hot Yoga of the Heart. Aspects of that teaching have become concentrated in the already large and growing community of realized teachers, transmitters, and also realized mentors, and many awakened practitioners, and many who are pursuing their awakening, which community network is known as Waking Down or Waking Down in Mutuality. The reason I'm saying this is because I love this observation, the distinction, Kali Rinpoche says, between Dzogchen and Mahamudra. The distinction is pointless because fundamentally these are two names for the same experience. And I would say fundamentally the ultimate realized condition in the White Hot Yoga of the Heart is similarly of the same stock. There are some distinctions worth pointing to that I will point to as we go. But I want to acknowledge we're talking about an ultimate and yet ultimately ordinary way of being in the world. And this will come through in great detail as we continue. So to continue with Daniel's preface. I later learned that Kali Rinpoche's father, a yogin and doctor, had been a disciple of the famous Mipham Rinpoche, one of the great Nyingmapa masters. Several learned masters of the school have confirmed that the Chan masters had had to retreat from Tibet after their defeat at the infamous debate of Samye, but that the Nyingmapa and the Kagyupa had preserved the essence of Chan under the names of Dzogchen and Mahamudra. Many academics today explore this route, and one may read with interest an article on the subject by Guilain Mala, published in Chan Zen, I'm going to venture pronunciation here, Racines et Florazel. Also of interest are Mahamudra, the Quintessence of Mind and Meditation, by Takpo Tashi Nyambyal, and A Spacious Path to Freedom, Practical Instructions on the Union of Mahamudra and Ati Yoga, by Karma Chagme, both of which treat this question in detail. Once familiarized with Chan, I was not surprised when I noticed that the teachings of the Bodhidharma on the two entrances is systematically taken up again in the Dzogchen and the Mahamudra, and that Dudjom Rinpoche and Kali Rinpoche reserved a significant amount of space for the subject in their teachings. When in 1975 I met the yogini Lalita Devi, who had become my master and who would transmit to me the teachings of the Pratyabhijna and Spanda of the Kashmiri Shaivism stream, I took it a step further and grasped the impact of the Kashmiri Siddhas on Tibetan Buddhism, which, by the way, Buddhifies the suttas to such a degree that Alain Danielu would go on to write that Tibetan Buddhism is Shaivism in disguise. One of the most striking examples is Saraha's Queen Doha, which includes the following stanzas. A Shaivite yogi, in whom a pseudo-existential pristine awareness, allegedly imparted to him by Shiva himself, has come about, and hence in whom there is no fear, will, whilst wearing the insignia of Shiva as a charm, look for a woman born in the outskirts. Taking in her qualities, he will reciprocate by offering his pristine awareness, reverberating within the intensity of immediate experience, and, for the time being, he will take this pristine awareness, heightened in its sensibility, through being's genuineness operating in it, approximating in flavor, being's nothingness replete with everything in highest perfection, as the Mahamudra experience. Scholars with Buddhist tendencies, uncomfortable with this passage, have it follow or replace it with similar verses, sometimes in parentheses, it is true, removing the allusion to Shaivism, just as they often delete purely and simply all allusion to Saraha's master, who was a Shaivite yogini. A comment here, interesting to me, that Daniel's primary teaching master, or one of them certainly, and the last of the one he mentions here, was a yogini, Lalita Devi, and Saraha's master, the great Saraha, his master was a Shaivite yogini. There's a long history in a number of these schools of women having been at the source foundations with the masters who, the male yogis, who then became the writers and the more famous expounders. Daniel goes on. It seems that in 7th and 8th century Kashmir, and even in later centuries, there reigned a great freedom of spirit, and that the yogis and yoginis, when it was a matter of realizing the ultimate, hardly worried about the etiquette of the masters, or about their belonging to one group or another. The great Abhinavagupta himself had many masters, some of whom were not Shaivite. What I am proposing here is to rediscover this opening of mind by presenting the texts of Chan, Dzogchen, and the Mahamudras, Chinese, Tibetan, and Kashmiri, texts that only mystical experience can bring together. Several of these essential texts have been translated here into English for the first time. The teachings that follow come from the greatest masters of Kashmiri, Tibetan, and Indian Tantrism, but also from the great Chan masters who passed on the essence of Mahamudra. Their names are, and I'm going to do my best with these names, Abhinavagupta, Kshemaraj, Vasugupta, Kalata, Utpaladeva, Lala, Savari, Virupa, Mazu, Nyuto, Taosin, Dahui, Chenwei, Foyan, Pao Che, Machig, Yunchia Swan, Che, Jairata, Padmasambhava, Vimalakirti, and Yuan Wu. I will add that in 2002, to commemorate this union of the three streams that had the strongest impact on me, I received in Catalonia the Chan ordination, Soto Zen lineage, from Master Kosen. What is a monk? According to Kosen, a monk is simply someone who is, quote, in harmony with the cosmos, unquote. A lovely definition that spatializes or brings space to the vows by bringing them back to unending unity. Finally, in the spring of 2004 in China, I met the Grand Chan Master Jinghui, Dharma heir of Zuyun, better known in the United States as Empty Cloud, who lived from 1839 to 1959, who is recognized as the foremost Chan master of the 20th century. My master Jingwei gave me the Chan ordination in the Linzi and Kadong schools, as well as the permission to transmit the Zhaozhu Chan spirit in the West. By the way, translator's note, if you heard 1839 to 1959 and thought, what? About empty cloud? These dates are correct. Zhu Yun, like Zhao Zhu, lived 120 years. Daniel goes on. How to be in harmony with the cosmos? It seems that certain preliminaries are indispensable. Rid yourself of all beliefs. Leave metaphysics to the sectarians of the absurd. Understand that hope is fear gone bad. Confront reality directly. Stop upholding the romantic dream of realization. Forget sentimental neurosis. Play with your own limits. Look at your confusion. Confront life without the bric-a-brac of the religious and the spiritual, without, for all that, becoming a narrow-minded materialist who would make a new god out of rationalism. Dare to be alone. Do not oppose essence against reality. Give yourself over to the pleasures of pure subjectivity. Understand that everything is real. And finally, one day, no exhilarating silence. Can one say that such a person is a mystic? According to the Shaivites, yes. According to the Chan masters, yes. According to the followers of Mahamudra, yes. In fact, all it takes is to say no to everything, or to say yes to everything, and to be an iconoclast who goes so far that he forgets the vehicle that brought him to this form of radical thinking. In short, it takes crazy wisdom. Now, I should mention here a couple of things. One is we'll have opportunity to explore some of this in great detail through Daniel's commentaries, especially on the text. Do we want to reduce hope to fear gone bad? In my work, I wouldn't go quite that far, but I do appreciate what he's pointing to there, and we'll get into it. Also, this term crazy wisdom, which Daniel is saying, meaning exactly what it says, crazy or apparently by certainly materialistic and rationalistic standards, also by many religious and spiritual standards, a kind of wisdom, a way of being in and viewing reality and participating that seems kind of mad. That term crazy wisdom has gotten some disrepute in recent years due to the behavior of certain adepts that many people have found wanting. And I appreciate that. In my work, we try not to manifest such behaviors in our work with students and disciples. In that sense, the Waking Down teachers and Linda Mama and myself, we all share an orientation that I suppose is somewhat along the lines of what Kali Rinpoche said to Daniel. I'm turning back here. He said you could, to Daniel, he could think of him, Kali Rinpoche, as his master or as his mother. And Daniel chose a second option. And certainly in our work, we lead with mothering, and that's part of what has made it and continues to make it quite extraordinarily effective in helping people awaken to something like this very crazy wisdom. Though there are great processes of continual refinement and purification, growth, harmonization, evolution that we go through in this work, that make the living of such wisdom all the more profound over time. So to complete Daniel's preface, the commentary on each stanza of the Spandakarika, or Song of the Sacred Tremor, comprises three parts, and this is important. The first part of each commentary is newly written by me, that is, by Daniel. The second is a quotation from one of the great masters of the Mahamudra tradition. The third is the transcription of an oral teaching given during my seminar on this text. The commentary on each of the three flows or parts of the Spandakarika is followed by a great poem, the first by the yogini Machig Labdron, the second by Padmasambhava, and the third by Talopa, who is the founder in India of what became the Kagyu sect, or lineage stream in Tibetan Buddhism. Two appendices follow. Appendix 1 is a translation of the complete text of the Vijnanabhairava Tantra. Appendix 2 is an alternate translation of the Padmasambhava poem that appears at the end of the second flow. Today, Daniel writes in conclusion, today, having made Mahamudra my sole practice, in contemplation before the unbridled sea, I know that knowledge divides and practice unites. So just a brief comment on Daniel's preface. As I think you can tell, he's a fine storyteller and a very delightful writer. Obviously a man of deep intelligence who's capable of putting things simply and, telling a great story. And to me, it was very moving to read. In 1967, he was 22. I was just then 17. It would be another 3 years before my great turning to the East would take place. And so in some ways, we've followed somewhat parallel paths. Mine through Hinduism, starting with the Kriya Yoga teachings of Swami Yogananda in Autobiography of a Yogi, which of course presented vignettes of many, many masters, especially of the Hindu tradition, leading then to a number of different encounters, and I'm not going to go into those stories here, eventually to the great masters of the heart, or Hridayam, Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi, and the one who was my primary life teacher. Ramana was no longer alive when I found his work, but his presence was certainly brilliantly obvious to me and continues to be to this day. And I was with him from May of 1972 until October of 1973, when I found the teachings of then known as Bubba Freejohn, originally Franklin Jones by his American name, and who eventually became known as Avatar Adida Samraj, and with whom I spent nearly two decades before being moved out, seemingly onto my own, but in truth, into the mysterious embrace of the Shakti, the great goddess. And among other things, all of that has led me to be in a position to presume not only to read aloud to you, but to comment from my own authority on what we'll now consider here, the ancient text, as well as these various pieces of quotations and poems that Daniel has so beautifully appended to support. The Spandakarika, the Tantric Song of the Sacred Tremor, So what we're considering now is a short introduction to the primary text. The Spandakarika, or Song of the Sacred Tremor, is one of the essential texts of Kashmiri Shaivism. Having been revealed at the beginning of the 9th century by Shiva to Vasugupta, or to say it more directly, having gushed forth like a spring from Vasugupta's own heart, it presents the essence of the Tantras in 52 marvelously elliptical stanzas. Now, a translator's note. The French word for tremor is, guessing here, frémissement, from the verb frémir, to tremor, quiver, shudder, thrill, or simmer, as in water. Daniel Odia uses this word to convey the idea of the Sanskrit spanda, which has been translated variously as vibration, the divine pulsation, or vibratory dynamism of the absolute consciousness. Here, the sacred tremor or tremoring will be used in the absence of a single English word that can adequately serve the rich meaning of the French and Sanskrit terms. So these 52 marvelously elliptical stanzas, and elliptical in this sense is meaning, among other things, very compressed and very structured. They were written by Vasugupta himself or by his disciple Kalata. Some say that Vasugupta received them in a dream while meditating in a cave in Mount Kailash, the mythical home of the trident-bearing god who gave birth to the sacred river Ganges. Semiraj, another important master of the tradition, who left a long commentary on the first stanza, and to whom we owe the magnificent Pratnabhijna Hridayam, or Heart of Recognition, said that Vasugupta found them carved into a rock, and the faithful of today still revere the site. Now, I have not read the notes from the preface, and I will only read those that are appealing to me to read from other pieces of the text. There's a note here. For more on the sacred tremor, see also Daniel Odia's book Desire, The Tantric Path to Awakening, also published by Inner Traditions. In his commentary, Semiraj stresses the fact that the Song of the Sacred Tremor is a presentation of Mahamudra, which would go on to become famous through the Tibetan lineage of transmission, and which is the ultimate teaching of the Kagyu school. Mahamudra is also often translated as the Great Seal, referring to the secret of this teaching and to the fact that it seals all that preceded it. But the Kashmiri is translated as the Great Cosmic Movement because its realization is linked to the yoga transmitted by Matsyendranath, who is at the source of the Kashmiri lineages. This Siddha probably lived in Assam in the 7th century of the Common Era. Abhinavagupta, the great 10th century philosopher and master, pays homage to Matsyendranath in his Tantraloka, which presents the sum of all knowledge on the Tantras. This yoga, the teaching of which has almost completely disappeared, is very profound. It seems to have been the form that preceded Hatha Yoga. Its very simplicity is what makes it so difficult. The most ancient masters of the tradition had come to the realization that all is movement in the universe. They saw everything, including matter, as consciousness, and they invented a yoga that fit this realization. The sacred dance, called Tandava, is carried out in three phases. During the first stage, the body is released into space, the breath settles in, and the sacred tremoring of the organs is welcomed by consciousness, which allows this inner palpitation to become free, and thus rejoins the limitless. Lalita Devi compared this sensation to the movements that moths flying within us might make. Little by little, the body lets itself go into an extremely slow, involuntary movement, where the limbs are carried by the breath in a circular unfolding. In the second phase, the yogi lets his arms open out into space, the spinal column extremely supple, the eyelids slightly open, the tongue relaxed, the perineum open, the breath freed. The shoulder blades are open like wings and give balance to the body, which is normally drawn more toward the front. This whole yoga is practiced visualizing oneself naked, floating in midnight blue space. In the third phase, the yogi gets up and allows his whole body to express the dance of Shiva in space. These movements look like a completely free kind of Tai Chi, in which no movement is codified. The sequential linking of these movements make up the whole Kashmiri yoga, such as I received its transmission from my master, Yogini Lalita Devi. This is an extremely subtle and difficult yoga that requires thousands of hours of practice. The advantage of this yoga is that it makes all other physical practice unnecessary. It can be seen in the sculptures of tantric temples and in Tibetan statuary and paintings, which almost always represent the yogin, the yogini, and the divinities in this supple lateral movement, and which one can imagine is omnidirectional. This tradition, so simple, so subtle, has gradually fallen into oblivion and been replaced by the more spectacular Hatha Yoga. The Spandakarika presents the philosophy that was born of this practice, and all the yoga does is keep bringing us back to the source of this fundamental realization. So it's very clear that Yoga Spandakarika is a very, very old, old, mysteriously compressed text, 52 short stanzas. Why, we might wonder, did many great realizers express themselves in such a manner? This text, also the Avadhut Gita of Indian yoga, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, the originating masters in some cases did present commentaries, in others did not. I think part of the reason that they expressed themselves in these ways was so that their disciples could easily memorize their teachings in this form and would be, I was going to say forced, but more like magnetized, attracted to contemplate the mysteries within them, to go over and over and over them as they would recite them or chant them, perhaps as part of a daily practice. They'd have the opportunity to explore the meanings and the mysteries, the tones and the sounds. Sanskrit, of course, is in some ways the ultimate magical mystery language of humankind. It's as I read recently, I think actually it may be in this book, you could spend 20 to 30 years studying Sanskrit and still feel like a beginner. So this is an old text. It's a mysterious text. It doesn't give you outright obvious meanings to what it's saying. And it is associated, and this is something I just want to draw our attention to, it's associated with a physical dance, or really a whole being dance, a sacred dance called Tandava, which has been known as the dance of Shiva. And after I read the song of the sacred tremor straight through, I'll close this first session by a little bit of more of personal commentary. I was thinking I would hold off on that till later, but then when I saw again the mention of the Tandava and the acknowledgement that the Spandakarika presents the philosophy that was born of the dance practice. So the dance preceded the concepts in this profoundly condensed and gem-like form. When I noticed that, I remembered that back at the beginning of my yoga, I was exposed to a Tandava practice, and that prompts me to end this first session by telling you a bit more of my story, which, as with Daniel Odier's story, especially if you're a listener who doesn't know much about me and my work, may give you some sense of my practice credentials. So, to read now the Song of the Sacred Tremor, and to honor the text itself, and we're going to trust that we have a fine translation here. I am sure we do, because Daniel is so obviously, to me, a great realized practitioner. I'm going to read these, and I am not going to provide, at this time, any commentary on them whatsoever. I will offer my commentary on the stanzas almost entirely in the context of commenting on Daniel Odier's commentary and on the poems and quotations that he includes as part of his commentary. So, Yoga Spandakarika, the Song of the Sacred Tremor. 1. The venerated Shankari, Shakti, source of energy, opens her eyes and the universe is reabsorbed in pure consciousness. She closes them and the universe is manifested within her. 2. The sacred tremor, the very place of creation and return, is completely limitless because its nature is formless. 3. Even within duality, the Tantrika goes straight to the non-dual source, because pure subjectivity always resides immersed within his own nature. And note here, the pronoun he is used throughout in this translation, simply in the interests of grammatical consistency. 4. All the relative notions tied to the ego rediscover their peaceful source, deeply buried under all the different states. 5. In the absolute sense, pleasure and suffering, subject and object, are nothing other than the space of profound consciousness. 6 and 7. To grasp this fundamental truth is to see absolute freedom everywhere. Thus, the activity of the senses itself dwells in this fundamental freedom and pours forth from it. 8. Therefore, the person who rediscovers this essential sacred tremor of consciousness escapes the dim confusion of limited desire. 9. Liberated in this way from the multiplicity of impulses tied to the ego, he experiences the supreme state. 10. Then the heart realizes that the true innate nature is both the universal agent and the subjectivity that perceives the world. Thus immersed in understanding, it knows and acts according to its desire. 11. How can this wonder-filled Tantrika, who always comes back to his own fundamental nature as the source of all manifestation, be subject to transmigration? 12. If the void could be an object of contemplation, where would the consciousness that perceives it be? 13. Therefore, consider contemplation of the vacuity as an artifice of a nature analogous to that of a profound absence from the world. 14, 15, and 16. Actor and action are united, but when action is dissolved by abandoning the fruits of the act, the very dynamic that is tied to the ego exhausts itself, And the tantrika who is absorbed in this profound contemplation discovers the divine tremor, liberated from its ties to the ego. The profound nature of action is thus revealed, and he who has interiorized the movement of desire no longer knows dissolution. He cannot cease to exist because he has returned to the profound source. 17. The awakened tantrika realizes this continuous sacred tremor throughout the three states. 18. Shiva is then in loving union with Shakti in the form of knowledge and its object. Whereas everywhere else, he is manifested as pure consciousness. 19. The whole palette of the different kinds of sacred tremoring finds its source in the universal sacred tremor of consciousness, and in this way reaches the person. How could such a sacred tremoring limit the tantrika? 20. And yet, the sacred tremor itself causes people who are subject to limited views to become lost because, their intuition being dissociated from the profound source, they throw themselves into the whirlwind of transmigration. 21. The person who with fieriness tends toward the profound sacred tremor reaches his true nature even within activity. 22. The profound and stable sacred tremor can be reached in extreme states, anger, intense joy, mental wandering, or the drive toward survival. 23-24. When the tantrika gives himself over to Shiva Shakti, the sun and the moon come up in the central channel. 25. At that moment, when in the sky the sun and the moon disappear, the awakened person remains lucid, whereas the ordinary person sinks into unconsciousness. 26 and 27. Mantras, when they are charged with the power of the sacred tremor, accomplish their function through the senses of the awakened person. They become united with the mind of the tantrika, who penetrates the nature of Shiva Shakti. 28-29. All things emerge from the individual essence of the tantrika, who recognizes himself in Shiva Shakti. Everything in which he takes pleasure is Shiva Shakti. Thus there is no state that can be named that would not be Shiva Shakti. 30. Always present to the reality that he perceives as the play of his own nature, the tantrika is liberated at the very heart of life. 31. Through the intensity of objectless desire, contemplation emerges in the heart of the tantrika, united to the profound sacred tremor. 32. This is the attainment of the supreme nectar, the immortality of samadhi, which reveals to the tantrika his own nature. 33 and 34. The ardor toward Shiva Shakti that manifests the universe allows the tantrika to be fulfilled. Over the course of the dream, the sun and the moon appear in his heart, and all his wishes are granted. 35. But if he is not present, the tantrika will be wronged by the play of manifestation, and he will experience the illusory state of the aspirant throughout waking and sleeping. 36, 37. Just as an object that escapes attention is more clearly perceived when we make the effort to see it better from all angles, so the supreme sacred tremor appears to the tantrika when he ardently strives toward it. In this way, everything is in tune with the essence of his true nature. 38. Even in a state of extreme weakness, such a tantrika succeeds in this accomplishment. Even starving, he finds his food. 39. With his only support, the recognition of the heart, the tantrika is omniscient and in harmony with the world. 40. If the body-mind is ravaged by discouragement due to ignorance, only the completely unlimited expansion of consciousness will dissipate a lassitude whose source will then have disappeared. 41. The revelation of the self, capital S, arises in the person who is now only absolute desire. May each of us have this experience. 42. Then may light, sound, form, and taste come and impede the person who is still tied to the ego. 43. When the Tantrika pervades everything with his absolute desire, what use are words? He has this experience on his own. 44. May the Tantrika remain present, his senses vigilantly sown in reality, and may he know stability. 45. The person who is deprived of his power by the dark forces of limited activity becomes the plaything of the energy of sounds. 46. Caught in the field of subtle energies and mental representations, the supreme ambrosia is dissolved, and the person forgets his innate freedom. 47. The power of the word is always ready to veil the profound nature of the self, because no mental representation can free itself from language. 48. The energy of the sacred tremor that passes through the vulgar person enslaves him, whereas the same energy liberates the person who is on the path. 49 and 50. The subtle body itself is an obstacle that is tied to limited intelligence and to the ego. The enslaved person has experiences that are tied to his beliefs and to the idea that he has of his body, and in this very way perpetuates the tie. That's 49 and 50. 51. But when the Tantrika becomes established in the sacred tremor of reality, he liberates the flow of manifestation and return, and in this way takes pleasure in the universal freedom as a master of the wheel of energies. 52. I venerate the spontaneous, tremoring, and wonderful words of my master who had me cross the ocean of doubt. May this jewel of knowledge lead all beings to reach the true nature of reality, and may they keep this jewel in the deepest part of their heart. And from there, we go into the commentary, the first flow, second flow, and third flow, and everything else in Daniel's marvelous text. So to conclude this first session, I'll just say a few things about myself and a little bit about my orientation and what I expect will come through as we get into the details as a somewhat alternative view from that presented by Daniel and by the great sages and saints, the tantric masters, chan masters, whom he quotes from. In 1970, having begun a religious and spiritual quest in mostly Western contexts, really at that point entirely so, I may have come upon Thomas Merton's teachings, such as Zen and the Birds of Appetite, before the great event that turned me profoundly to the East. And that was upon having read Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda, which opened my eyes to the whole amazing world of Asian Indian yoga and subtle and transcendental experience. I had an immediate, spontaneous, rocket shot-like ascent from a sense of being at the center of my brain, infinitely above, into what I knew not until having come instantaneously whirling as light back into my body after some indeterminate space of time that I sensed may have been only a few seconds, but I inferred that I had just been blown into infinity. The very nirvikalpa samadhi, the formless ecstasy of ultimate divine union that Yogananda and his masters and the Indian sources he quoted were pointing to. This set me on my path. My first serious yoga teacher, I wasn't moved toward Yogananda's path, primarily because I had come out of political activism and still had a kind of revolutionary fervor in that sense, which, by the way, has never left me. It's just taken the form of my entire life's quest and then my work. So my first teacher was a great, very mysterious, very powerful, and very controversial master of Tantra Yoga, Kundalini Yoga, named Sri Sri Anandamurti, the founder of the Ananda Marga Yoga movement. And it was in his company that I learned and did a little bit of practicing of a version of the Tandava, the dance of Shiva. But after some time, I felt I was not going to be able to replicate that great samadhi very well through trying to practice my way up the chakras. I was drawn to the teachings eventually of Bhagavan Sri Ramana Maharshi, the great sage of South India, who had died in 1950, just a couple of weeks before my birth, actually. This was in the spring of 1972, so nearly 2 years later, in early May, on a farm in Canada. I was visiting with a friend, and I were visiting people we'd met who were among the inner circle of Ram Dass's companions as devotees of the great master Neem Karoli Baba, Maharaji of India. And while at that farm, I saw a little book of Maharshi's teachings, Who Am I? And the teachings didn't speak to me. They seemed kind of dry discussions of the self. But his eyes, picture of him taken as a very young man, were utterly magnetic, like coal black cinders somehow still on fire. And I resolved to find out more about him, and that very night in Montreal, found a book of his teachings and tried his prescribed yoga of asking, who am I, self-inquiry, while meditating on, he said, the place of consciousness is in the heart, on the right side of the chest. And I tried that, and I felt this, as I describe it, an infinitesimal immensity, you know, something utterly transcendental and yet on fire, white hot. It's as if it leaped forward and up this infinitesimal distance in my heart of hearts. And from then on, I always felt that place. There were waves of bliss that ran through me, and the experience was quickly over. I didn't dissolve into it the way I had when I first read Yogananda's book. But Maharshi then became my guru. And after about a year and a half, I realized that though I was having profound intuitions of consciousness and loved meditating on his presence and his photograph, gazing with his eyes, with him through his eyes, through that photograph, I, in despair, realized that I needed a teacher who would help me make sense of my life. And in short order, that led me to the American tantric and sage, eventually self-proclaimed avatar, who became known as Adida Samraj. And I spent 19 years with Adida, and it was in his company that I was initiated temporarily, though I didn't know it at the time, in 1989, I was initiated to an intensification of the awakened condition that he called by a variety of names, but which I later came to call simply the white heat. And in 1992, I found it necessary to leave his work and go out on my own and hope and pray that I could reach the realization that had been still eluding me all those years. And what wound up happening was that the great goddess, the Shakti, came to me. She had already been pulling me out in manners that I hadn't yet recognized. But in a period of a few months, 4 months or so, from leaving Adida's work in early August of 1992 until early December, there was this rapid-fire quickening of my process, my sadhana, my practice, and in its ultimate form in terms of the investigation of consciousness, but also in a profound tantric form, both of which culminated in the first sexual union that I had since leaving my guru, Adida, that summer, which had been precipitated by my second wife and his community leaving me. And in this obviously tantric, sexual tantric initiation that took place spontaneously with a new partner, there was then a seeding of an opening that became evident after the second night my partner and I spent together that morning, sitting at a restaurant called the Good Earth in a town of Larkspur or Greenbrae, California. I was waiting for my breakfast, a big sumptuous breakfast of eggs and bacon and pancakes. I was waiting for it to be delivered, and something moved me to look out the window, and in that moment of looking out, I realized the great unity. But it was only some years later that I was able to bring in the white-hot intensification of that unity, interestingly enough, on a pilgrimage to India in the spring of 1994, and even more interestingly, in actual sexual union with my then partner. This was another woman who joined me in this tantric dance. There were a number in those early years. And it was while we were in sexual union at the ashram, Sri Ramana Ashramam, the ashram of that great sage Ramana Maharshi, that this white heat stabilized itself at the root foundation of my knowing. And it was the same white-hot infinitesimal immensity that had come to me initially through Ramana's presence that I had had access to in some sense even before then, through reading Yogananda's book and gaining, being given the blessings of Yogananda and his masters, especially, I think, the mysterious, deathless sage Babaji. But now this white heat was brimming over in me at all times. And early on in my work in 1992, after that initial realization in December, I had started my work. It's continued all these years, and this white-hot intensity, which to me is another way of describing the sacred tremoring, the spanda, the sphurana of manifestation. That was a word Maharshi used. So these words are all describing something that is as totally physical as it is transcendental, and there is no distinction between the two or any of the parts. Ultimately, there is no distinction, while our capacity to dance within distinctions in these relative lives is a measure of our true, to use Daniel's phrase, which he got from one of his masters, harmony with the cosmos. So I will stop there for now. This has been a bit of a longish first session. Most of the following sessions will be shorter. Some may be this long. Remains to be seen. Thank you for listening, and welcome to the sacred tremor that sets our hearts free to love. I hope you'll come forward and do this journey over this next year with me as we go through these 52 stanzas and Daniel Odier's marvelous commentary and the brilliant expositions of great sages and saints from ancient days. Thanks so much. Blessings and love. Bye-bye.